Dr. McGilchrist, thank you so much for the...
Do you mind if we kick off with the music?
Of course, yes.
Sorry.
Yes.
I just thought it would be rather fun. It's a piece of music in a quite different vein. We're going to have, I think music's important. And it's a setting of words from Ecclesiastes that you will all be familiar with. But as a song by Judy Collins and Pete Seeger from the 1960s. I just think it's utterly brilliant. Can you play it for us? Thank you. No, that's another thing. But I don't know, there's just been a lot of deaths around me in the recent months, and I found myself returning to that often. There's something beautiful about the way the two relate. Pete Seeger wrote the song, actually. The words are an adaptation from Ecclesiastes. But just watching them is also better than actually just listening.
Well, here we can dive into the deep end, really, because in the conflict in Gaza at the moment. This passage of scripture has been quoted. It's a time for war, it seems, a very sad moment.
Indeed.
Can I ask a personal question there? How did you get into this stuff?
Into which stuff?
into the philosophic notion.
Into this mess.
Yes, and the structure of the brain, hemispheric theory, and then developed sort of philosophical thinking from that. Why were you interested in that?
Well, I suppose there were certain things that I've always believed were important, but weren't what I was being taught. So as a teenager, I thought that it was quite clear that the whole was more than the sum of the parts. But sort of clever people sneered and said, well, what's this something extra then that gets put in? In fact, of course, the problem is that it's not that something needs to be put in, but that something is lost when you take something apart. But anyway, and I also thought, you know, things don't move in straight lines, but probably more in circles or spirals, that opposites tend to come together. All these things were not what I was taught. And, you know, the aim of the intellect to dissect everything was useful up to a point, but wasn't an end, that we needed to reintegrate what we knew. And I didn't come from a religious family at all, but my schooling introduced me to many important aspects of the Christian culture and faith. And so that became important to me. And then, to cut a very long story short, I was going to read theology and philosophy at Oxford, but it wasn't an honours degree. And the people who interviewed me said, well, you can't do a non-honours degree. You better do English, which I sat the entrance exam in. So I did that. But then I thought there's something wrong with the way in which people deal with a poem or a play or a work of art of any kind, music or anything else, which is that the thing is essentially unique. It's essentially embodied and it's essentially implicit. And we took it and made it general in nature, disembodied it and made it explicit. We moved in the exact opposite way from which the work of art was leading us. I thought there was a problem here, and that problem seemed to me to be to do with the mind-body relationship. And I went to, had a fellowship which allowed me to do exactly what I wanted for 7 years with no questions asked. And one of the things I did was go to all the philosophy seminars on these topics, and I just thought they were too disembodied and I need to do it in a more embodied way. And that meant studying medicine. I was inspired by Oliver Sacks, who at that time had just published Awakenings, which is a brilliant way of expressing what I've been talking about. He looked at individual cases and brings them to life, but he also is, through those individuals, getting hold of deep principles. And I thought this is a marvellous thing to do, to understand people's, you know, the lives of real people. When something goes wrong with their brain or their body, and it affects their whole way of being and vice versa. So that led me to medicine. Cut a long story short, 14 years later I was a psychiatrist. But in doing that, I came across the work of a man called John Cutting, who had studied the right hemisphere. And when I was in medical school, nobody really knew what the right hemisphere was for. It was like, here be dragons, you know, nothing really going on. And then it turned out that actually everything important was going on there. And that one of the really interesting things for me was hearing him say one day that the right hemisphere doesn't understand implicit meaning. It has to be made explicit. It doesn't understand metaphors, poetry, humour, anything like that.
Mm.
And that it's much less in touch with the left hemisphere is much less in touch with the body. The right hemisphere is more in touch with emotions and with the autonomic nervous system and is therefore more engaged with the body. And this embodied context, this individuality, and this need for things to be implicit rather than explicit, suddenly hit home. There's something happening here where my right hemisphere knows what a poem is, but my left hemisphere, the speaking hemisphere, is trying to describe this, but is doing it the only way it knows, which is to take it apart and make it something it isn't. And so I thought, right, I need to know more about hemispheres. And, you know, everybody warned me not to, because it's, you know, terrible pop psychology. Nobody will take you seriously. But I thought, well, just because we've got it wrong up till now doesn't mean to say that this is an important question. We need to find the right answer. And so that's how I got into all this work.
It seems to me one of the words that you use very strongly all the way through is relationships.
Yes.
and as complex as the brain is, would it be true to say that relationships are more complex, kind of to the power of 10 in the sense? If we're not in good relationships, we're fundamentally not happy people.
Well, absolutely. Everything is a relationship, as I tried to say. And there are three particularly important relationships for fulfillment, and they're each of them very hard to fulfill in the culture we're now in. One is, it's not my opinion just, there's a mass of social psychological research on this that shows that the three things that really make people feel fulfilled and happy are the relationship to a social group where they feel they belong, where they know they can trust people because they share the same values, they talk the same way, and they can share their lives with these people. And having a stable community like that matters enormously. Incredibly hard to find now, as even the family is disintegrating because of the ways we think about what's important in life. The second thing is our relationship to nature. And there's a vast body of research on this that shows that even small amounts of immersion in a natural context makes an enormous difference to our cognitive sharpness, our spiritual awareness, and our emotional and physical health. So people who spend time in a natural setting, not necessarily hiking or skydiving, but just actually being there and appreciating that world, are healthier, both physically and mentally. And the other one is the relationship with the divine. And I'm sorry, it just is true that having that sense leads to all kinds of benefits of a utilitarian kind. I mean, it's not a reason for having a spiritual sense, but since we live in the utilitarian world, it does actually produce enormous benefits. In fact, its effects on physical health alone are equal to giving up smoking, losing weight, and going to the gym several times a week. Of course, it's far more important than that for one's mental well-being, for feeling some sense of contentment, fulfillment, belonging, all these things that we now lack. So these three relationships to one another as human beings, to the natural world as our home, and to the divine cosmos, these are the three things. And yet we spend all our time running after good things that will make us happy, but they don't for a minute.
Mm-hmm. One of the potential or theoretical benefits of a church community is a group of people who, in their worship and their praying and their interaction together, can learn something about community and what it means to be human vis-a-vis the other.
Yes.
But it's a bunch of volunteers who come, or it's a bunch of people, you don't have a membership as such. You take what you get. Do you observe, either within religious groups or other groups in society, groups that are quite intentional about this right hemisphere stuff? Whilst there's attention to the practical and the detail, nevertheless an openness to new experience, to new perspectives, to living with that which is different, and being okay with that.
Well, we all have to negotiate the polarities here. We need familiarity and we need stability, but we don't want them to turn into a sort of empty boredom or fossilization. So a society that doesn't have enough of what the left hemisphere prizes will not hang together, but something that doesn't have enough of what the right hemisphere prizes will never be alive. So all creatures are doing a balancing act between stasis and change, and between the familiar and the unfamiliar. And a society can't just be everybody unfamiliar, but it's better that it's not entirely just those who are familiar.
Can I ask you about prayer then? You touched on that. What neural processes happen when somebody prays, or mindfulness? Is that something that's observable under the imaging techniques and so on. What happens in the brain?
Well, it is, but I mean, I would caution, first of all, I mean, a lot of people who are not in the business of imaging think that we can really just watch the brain working and see what's going on. It's far, far more complex than that. I mean, just say, I know you will appreciate that, but I'm just saying that because it's not like that at all. I mean, sometimes areas that light up are not involved in what's going on at all. Sometimes they're lighting up because they're inhibiting something rather than making something happen. And one complication is that the easier the brain finds it, the less work it has to do, and therefore those errors don't show up on a scan, although they're crucial. So interpreting a scan is a nightmare. And you have to balance it with other things like EEGs, which have their own problems. They're not very good at localizing, but they're extremely time sensitive, whereas a functional MRI is not time sensitive. Its image comes out of several seconds during which things may have gone and come and back again. So to cut a long story short, it's not the panacea of, you know, it's not the thing we can go to and say, well, now we understand it. However, some things are rather more interesting, like areas of the brain that expand through certain kinds of practice. And important areas in the right cingulate, which is a very important part of the brain that mediates between what we think of as cognition and emotion, expands when people do meditative prayer. Mm. And compassion meditation also helps grow areas of the right hemisphere. And similarly, of course, they can shrink if they're not used. So the brain is, in a degree, responsive to what we make it do.
Is neuroplasticity a thing?
It is.
It is. Okay.
It's a very real thing.
So what does that mean?
Well, you may well ask, and the more we know about it, the less we understand it, but which is as it should be. What it effectively means is that we now know. When I was in medical school, we were taught that, you know, most of the body can regenerate itself pretty well, the nervous system not so well, and, you know, particularly the brain. But actually we do know that the brain can take unguided steps to heal itself. In fact, a friend of mine who was just staying with me 3 days ago, Norman Doidge, wrote a book called The Brain That Heals Itself, which became a number one bestseller in America. And I think it makes this very important point that the brain is responsive to circumstances. What is amazing, though, how do you explain this? That suppose you have an injury and you lose a part of the brain that has a certain function. After a while, another part of the brain will take over that function. And so how exactly does that happen? I mean, in a machine, if a cog or whatever it is breaks, another cog doesn't say, well, I'll step into that and make myself the right. So there's knowledge, as it were, in the body. There's knowledge in every organism that is hidden, but it can be brought into action. And for example, can I just expand on this a bit?
Sure.
A single-celled organism has a kind of intelligence. If you define intelligence as not just following rote instructions, but actually being able to see what the problem is here and adapt and defeat the problem, a single cell can do this. It can be aware that some other part of the cell is damaged, and it can begin to repair it, even if it's subjected to a kind of insult, as we say, which it couldn't be prepared for by biological history or by the history of the organism. So they can make leaps of imagination, of a creative kind. No machine does this. I'm just talking about a single cell, never mind. We've got billions and billions and billions of these cells. And also, by the way, we don't have to wait around for literally millions of years for a random mutation to turn up to solve a problem. In certain circumstances, organisms can develop a mutation that is important for them in about 4 days, that if it was done entirely by chance would take literally millions of years. So I'm not saying that, you know, that God is an engineer who's poking around in the machinery all the time, but the whole business of it, we're not machines. We're part of a creation which is itself imaginative and creative and responsive.
Up until last Saturday, I used to always have a rugby metaphor for almost everything. So up until last Saturday, I would have said it reminds me of a rugby team where somebody goes down and there leaves a gap that somebody has to move in. So it's a kind of a team thing.
Yes.
But because it's happening as the game's flowing, you can't sort of stop and say, what's going on here? No. It has to happen intuitively as it's going.
Is exactly.
It the kind of,
exactly.
There's a kind of intuitive functionality within the physical stuff.
There is. That's absolutely right. And the more you know about it, the more improbable this idea that somehow it's all random and mechanistic is all wrong.
Yeah. One of the areas that troubles us as ministers is mental health.
Yes.
And stress.
Yes.
And clergy, all the research says clergy are actually quite poor at looking after themselves. That's one thing. And on the other side, clergy look after a lot of people who got mental health issues.
Exactly.
Presumably, you know, other human-facing organisations and professionals that you talk to are in the same kind of situation. Trying to look after one's own self, neurologically, mentally, whilst looking after people in society, sometimes quite troubled.
Absolutely, and people who wish to help others are drawn to certain professions, including that of being a priest and that of being a doctor. And doctors are equally bad at looking after themselves. I remember when it's not your own fault, it's the fault of the system, but when I was a junior hospital doctor, it was still legal, it isn't legal now, to work as I did, 120 hours a week. Well, there are only 184 hours in the week. And I had a family too. And I was tired and at times rather down. And I thought if I went to myself as a doctor and said this, I said, well, tell me about how you live. I say, I work very, very long hours. I never get regular sleep. If I manage to sleep, I'm bleeped to go and deal with something. Nobody ever tells me I'm doing a good job. I only ever hear about it when I've done a bad job. I get very irregular meals because I have to snatch something when it's available. And I don't get to see my family. And I'd say, well, I think you know what the problem here is. So under those circumstances, you can't really do much about it. The system is somewhat changed. And that has pros and cons. But I would think that for clergy, I mean, it's very difficult. I often think this because sometimes you need to be able to assert boundaries and say, no, I'm not available at the moment. It's very difficult for a clergyman or, you know, to do that. And so knowing how to make boundaries that will at least allow you to carry on being sane is quite important, not just for you, but for the work you do, because, of course, you're no use to anybody if you're completely exhausted and unmotivated.
As a psychiatrist, you must see these kinds of issues coming to you all the time, people who are well-meaning but in actual fact not looking after themselves very well.
I do, and I also used to get people who were in other kinds of professions where they weren't particularly interested in doing good to others but would just run ragged. So it's a common modern malaise that we don't know how to use our time.
Yeah.
And there is a sort of belief which is entirely false that, of course, one of the marvellous things about modernity is that it's much easier life than it used to be. And one thinks of the peasants before the Industrial Revolution and so on. But actually, they had extraordinary amounts of leisure. Even in the Ancien Régime, before the revolution in France, peasants had 180 days holiday a year. I mean, that includes Sundays, I know, but it's a lot.
Yeah.
And the working day would often include a long stretch in the middle of the day when you ate and drank and slept. And so it's absolutely not true. And we have this image of a sort of poor, harassed person in a garret somewhere. This only happened with the coming of the Industrial Revolution. And the Industrial Revolution is the left hemisphere going, we don't just make food for our community. We make far more than we need, and I get incredibly rich selling it to other people. And that was when people knew true poverty. They were uprooted from their rural community, probably for the, you know, breaking a chain of hundreds of years. They went to live in squalid conditions where they were time managed all the time. And so it's not true that somehow we've broken away from this. We are actually afflicted with it. We're, you know, very afflicted by poverty of time. And somebody told me that in the Diocese of Truro, 29 parishes or benefices or whatever they are were sort of amalgamated into one big, so I don't know what you call it now, but it's an administrative thing, run by two clergy, one of whom didn't work on Sundays. So I thought, you know, I'm not sure I've got the answer to that one, except that we need to look after the clergy. There's an interesting thing happened in Japan. Japanese airlines went bust, and they wanted to get it back on track, so they appointed a new CEO, a 75-year-old Buddhist monk. And he got the Japanese airlines back into profitability within a year, floated on the International Stock Exchange, and it's now worth squadrillions. And people said, well, what did you do? And he said, well, if you want eggs, be nice to the hens. It's true, isn't it?
Yeah, very good.
So the church should look after its clergy, and the clergy need to look after themselves. I mean, in a way, adults all need to look after themselves. It's easier said than done. But if you don't look after yourself, who exactly are you asking to do the job for you?
So we're living in a world, aren't we, where institutions themselves seem to be left hemisphere driven.
Absolutely.
Very anxious, very concerned with the bottom line.
Absolutely.
And will drive, in a utilitarian way, the people to be effectually functioning.
Yes, yes. And firms that are successful, despite all this, are those often their old family firms that run with a different ethos. They value and include their workers. And they do very well, because amazingly enough, if you produce a good product, people will buy it. It's not just about hype. And you know, we've just lost the idea of being genuine, of being ethically aware. We think we can make money by quick cuts which actually cut deep into real human lives, and that's not a way for the future.
I like the idea of the church being a family firm.
Yes,
it's got a nice quite a nice image.
Is it?
It's got a nice image. It is a family firm. Yes, yes.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Well, theoretically, isn't it?
It's not what I hear from some clergy, but.
Well, let me push that a little bit, because when you were talking about the Iroquois and the story of the two brothers, for instance, there's also a story that Jesus told about two brothers. And I wondered whether that was a kind of left hemisphere, right hemisphere thing, where the older brother, the prodigal son story, the older brother is rude, arrogant, but matter of fact goes off and finds himself. Idios, he comes to his own mind, it says, and then comes back to a kind of a left hemisphere brother who's anxious about the farm and doing right and all this kind of stuff. And I don't know, it was kind of a half-formed thought. I wondered whether there was something.
I think you might be stretching it to fit it onto the hemisphere coat hanger, but there's something in that, isn't there? I mean, there are moments, aren't there, in which there are hard stories for us, you know, like Mary and Martha and all these things that don't seem to us quite right, but Jesus saw that actually, you know, the one that is the sinner may well be the more important person when they come back to the fold, and
okay, I'll have another go then, since you're probably for those of us who have been trained in the last couple of hundred years in church to become specialised in things like exegesis and historical criticism, literary criticism and all this kind of stuff, yet the church seemed to get on pretty well okay with a fundamentally allegorical interpretation of the scriptures and so forth, which seemed to be more about the myth and the story and relationships and so on. Have we got away a little bit from really understanding our core texts because of our fetish for kind of close analysis?
I imagine there's something in that, yes. I think we think that literal truth is superior to metaphorical truth. And that's because we're used to dealing with extremely simple practical tasks. But in reality, it's not that there is a literal truth, and that's the real prize that we need to get at. And metaphorical truth is a kind of decoration around the edges. All real truths are metaphorical, and literal truth is just a very special case of them. It is a subset of metaphorical truth. So, I mean, this has been written about a lot by philosophers of various kinds, and we understand anything only by a metaphor. If I say, I understand it, what we mean is, it's like something else now that I do understand. So everything that we say we understand is because we've likened it to something else that we think we already know. And so metaphors build on metaphors, and we need to be careful of metaphors. We need to be careful of which metaphors we use, because those will disclose some aspects of things, but others will disclose others. So if you see a human being as an embodied soul, you see something different from what you see if you think it's a rather defective piece of AI. And these are, of course, extreme examples, but we are always using metaphors to understand everything. The word metaphor is a metaphor. It means to carry across, like a bridge. So it's making a bridge between our understanding and the world. And even, you know, the most abstract words, like abstract, means to drag something away. It's very physical. So in the end, all our language comes back to physical actions. And so when we're thinking about understanding something, we can get obsessed with a kind of precision which is inaccurate. So, for example, one of the keepers in the Natural History Museum in London was amazed on passing through the Great Hall where the dinosaur skeletons are to hear one of the guards telling a group of awestruck American tourists, this skeleton is 9,000,006 years old. And afterwards, the keeper went up to him and said, how do you know it's 9,000,006 years old? And he said, well, it was 9,000,000 years old when I came here, and that was 6 years ago. So there is a kind of precision which is actually inaccurate. And I know etymology may seem unimportant, but it actually tells us where things come from. Precise means, from Latin, precisos, cut off too soon. Cut off before its time. Whereas accurate means exhibiting care towards something, ad curare. And so accuracy is far more important than precision, because in all the really important things, there is no precision. But we can be accurate, at least as accurate as we should always be as accurate as we can be.
How do we apply that to relationships? Does that mean we must really, really pay attention to the other person, using a word? We must be very careful in our listening.
Absolutely. I mean, attention is love. This is what I was saying. And there is no love that is inattentive. So, yes, we do need to exhibit that care towards another in a relationship. And we also need to get a balance between, once again, a relationship thrives when it neither collapses into one or flies apart into two. It's a modulated... It's a dance. And in a way, it's like two heavenly bodies that circle one another. It wouldn't be better if they crashed into one another and smashed up. Wouldn't be better if they flew apart, and that would be the end of the relationship. Mm-hmm. So a relationship is something which each respects the otherness of the other, without that diminishing the self. When you respect the other, that other may help fulfill you as you are. It is a win-win. No, but it's actually a mutually enriching business, a functional relationship. A dysfunctional relationship causes diminishment of one of the persons in it. But you don't lose yourself in entering into a mature relationship. You find yourself.
Can I quote you? You talk about clergy at one point here. I found the word clergy in the book on page 1295.
Oh dear, what did I say?
So I thought I'd I thought I'd quote it back to you.
Oh yeah.
Yes, it's a commonplace that while the Victorians did not talk about sex, they were open about death. We do not talk about death, but are clinically explicit about sex. Unfortunately for us, being open about something robs it of its power, while hiding increases it. Then you go on to say, the clergy are no exception to this costly aversion of the eyes from death. Perhaps like some doctors, some priests, strangely enough, just don't know how to deal with suffering and would prefer everyone to be mindlessly happy.
Yep. I did say it and I did mean it. I mean, the phrase, the costly aversion of the eyes from death, some people may recognise as a quote from a wonderful poem by Philip Larkin about a hospital. But what came to mind, and I think I described there, is what happened when each of my parents, now long dead, died. And my brother and I wanted to... They weren't particularly religious people at all. I don't think they ever went to church voluntarily. I don't think they were averse to religious faith, they just didn't embody much of it. But they lived a decent life, both of them, and were very kind and good people. Anyway, when it came to burying them, we thought, well, probably this is more about us than them. They won't mind if we have a proper burial service. In fact, they'll probably be happy with that. And it would mean a lot to my brother and myself. Now, we're those terrible people that you all anathematize, who both of us love the older rites, which we know our parents said, our parents' parents said, our parents' parents' parents said, when death, which is the common lot of human beings, happened. And so we asked the clergyman, a different person on each occasion, could you just say the words of the prayer book as they're written? Neither of them could bring themselves to do it, because in their decent, modern, liberal minds, nothing really terrible should be at stake. And usually the funeral rite is carried... Everything now, we've lost solemnity, we've lost gravity, we've lost that profundity in which we realise we're actually up against something for the first time for a long time that really means something, that really matters. So the clergy, in my view, entirely inappropriately go into putting people at rest and telling them where the lavatories are and making little jokes. I don't think this is a good way to go at all, and no wonder the churches are empty. We can all get all that stuff at home. What we need is a place where we go which is other, which encapsulates the holy. Anyway, the long story is, short of this story, is that neither of the clergy could bring themselves to say these words. Because, you know, there are these terrific words, you know, let us not for any pains of death to fall from, suffer us not for any pains of death to fall from thee. And, you know, it's good to be brought up against the idea that something really important is at stake here. So I think the church is, I'm not a clergyman, you have to listen to what I have to say. You don't have to, you can walk out, but I'm here to say what I see, which is that in a mistaken move, I believe the church has thought, oh, it's all too old-fashioned and it's all too unappealing to the young. But actually the young are fed up with all the things that you think in your slightly old-fashioned way that the young would love. The young don't really want the sort of kinds of maternity be important to the service. They get that at home. What they want is to go somewhere for the first time where they feel a sense of something awe-inspiring and transcendent. And for me, that happened when I... It happened partly through the Catholic Church, but it happened much more when I went to Greece and then particularly to Brezhnev's Russia and went to see the services in what was then Leningrad. And watching these people filling the churches and thugs outside in leather jackets and dark glasses, photographing them all as they went in and out. And what we knew was that that meant that these people's children would never get to university and so on and so forth. But the sense in those cathedrals, with the timeless music, the timeless words, the icons, the physical expression of humility, it's indescribably real. It's far more real than anything I've ever experienced in the Church of England. Sorry to say this, folks. So when people say, what we need to do is to have sort of modern missions that will bring... I think what you'd do very well to do is to get some of the monastic communities to take turns for short whiles in big cities to take a place in the centre of the city and carry out solemn rituals. And people would come in and they'd say, I don't know what's going on here, but they see something amazing happening. And they'd stay and they'd ask, what is happening here? And they'd learn about it. And they'd learn out of a desire to learn, not just after going there and being lectured. Now, this is in this book, and this is what you need to do to be a Christian. So I think my 2 pennies worth. Do it what you like.
It makes me think, though, that the solemn rituals of the past, at least, and perhaps in other countries, really have to do with life and death.
Absolutely.
And we're not very good.
We're estranged from death.
We are, yeah.
And, you know, in the past, I have skulls in my house, but mainly animals. But a scholar like myself would have had a human skull on the table from an early age and would be acquainted with death because brothers and sisters would have died and so on. Yeah. We all had to grow up much earlier and face suffering and death. But suffering and death are not negative. Now we want to get, sort of, can we triumph over them? Well, no. Funnily enough, the less people get out of life, the more they want to cling on to it. So the more pointless people find life, the more terrified they are of death. But I see death as the natural companion of life, the fulfilment of it.
One of the things that you said somewhere is that at times in history, recorded history, 6th century BC in the Augustan era, and then the 15th and 16th century, there was a wonderful balancing of the hemispheres, but in each case it drifted towards the left.
Yes.
To the left hemisphere's point of view.
Yes.
Why is that? Why is there that propensity for us, however much we try to appreciate the art and beauty and so forth, for this drift to take place?
Yes, it's a good question and one I'm often asked. And it's best laid out in just a couple of pages in the introduction to the new version, so post-2019, of The Master's Emissary. But, in short, I think what happens is that a society begins by the working together of people who trust one another, who make sacrifices, who exhibit extraordinary courage and endurance to create a stable society. And then that flourishes and grows, and it has time to do what we think of as higher things, like to introduce the arts and philosophy and so on, and their lives become more, as we would think it, creative and civilized. And then there's a third phase in which people become entitled. They think all this is natural, or even rubbish in some sort of way, not realizing what sacrifices were made to bring this about. And so in those situations, things begin to fall apart. The civilizations have a natural tendency to do this. What it happens is that they overreach themselves. They become too big and too affluent. And under those circumstances, they no longer concern themselves with the things that actually sustain us. And they have physically a problem of how to govern a very large region. They have now colonies. So how do you do that? Instead of doing things in a more one-to-one sort of way, you roll out, as we now say, a kind of whole blanket of bureaucratic principles and rules that are to be followed everywhere. And so spontaneity, creativity goes out of the window. The harmony of parts, it doesn't matter. Just roll it out as big as possible everywhere. And this is the expression of the left hemisphere. And now we not only have a cancer of bureaucracy and administration, which has grown out of all proportion hyperbolically during my lifetime, which now sits on top of and strangles all human ventures. But we now have to contend with AI, which is the left hemisphere on steroids. And, you know, this is part of why our civilization is, in my view, heading, unless we're very careful and have a sudden rejuvenation of our spiritual sense, is heading for ruin.
In St. Paul's letter to the Romans, he says in a well-known passage, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds, so that you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect." So right from the early time in the church, there was this call for a transformation of mind, a transformation of one's orientation. It's a kind of a similar kind of call that needs to echo down through the centuries, in a sense. What does that mean for us, do you think, in terms of how we might attend to this transformation that you're calling for?
Well, I think it's putting what I'm saying in better words and at a higher level. But what I'm suggesting is that we think we've got problems, but in fact we've got a vast predicament. And problems can be solved, but this can't necessarily be solved in that way so that we can all carry on with business as usual. I don't believe that business as usual is sustainable. So I think we have to do nothing less than renew our hearts and minds. And that means seeing things differently from the way we've been trained to see them. But it's not as difficult as that sounds. We can begin right now to refuse to go along with certain ways of talking and thinking, above all with things that we know perfectly well in our hearts are untrue, but we are obliged to pay lip service to them. Throughout history, that has always been bad, and that was something that St. Paul was inveighing against. So we should trust more to what our wisdom of experience, our reason and our intuition tell us, and begin to see that in a spiritual context, because I think Solzhenitsyn said that a tree that doesn't have a proper core will not stand, and I believe that we're in that position where there is no core that we can all refer to, that we can all honour and we can cleave to and will inspire us to do what we need to do to carry on whatever it is we can, which is going to look different from what we've been doing in the past.
Sounds to me like a task of every family or of every group.
It is. Yeah. Absolutely that. But most importantly, because we think always in these terms we get from the news. You know, in many ways, news is a mixed blessing. After I published The Master and His Hemisphere, a Dutch journalist wrote to me with an article he'd written called 13 Reasons Why Not to Watch the News. And they're actually very good ones. But the trouble is that we now feel in a way that, you know, Jane Austen would never... All kinds of ghastly things were going on in the world, but she didn't have to try and worry about all of those. She was concerned with the community she was in and was able to... You know, people in those days had a more manageable feeling of the world that they were in. Now we're all citizens of the world, but in a bad way. It's right that we should care, of course, about what goes on in other parts of the world and be concerned about it. But it can lead to a sort of feeling of helplessness. You know, I'm so small and it's so big. And, you know, when I say to people that the renewal can start and indeed must start with you, they're a bit surprised because they say, well, you know, what good am I? And the answer is, I can't measure how good you are. And you don't know how good you are until you start doing it. We know examples from the last 100 years of single individuals whose example changed society and changed the way we think. And it's estimated that if 3% of people begin to think coherently and express a view of a certain kind, it will gain enough traction to have momentum of its own and will begin to influence society. So if each of you go out of here and speak to 4 people about how they need to be more right hemispheric, we'll have done the job. And that's just the people in this room. So how big is love? How big is the sacred? The left hemisphere wants an answer because it measures things and wants more quantity. But when you really experience love, all you can say is that it's deeper than the oceans and wider than the sky. You know, it's not... How big is that, by the way? How do you know that that doesn't matter to the cosmos? I think it does matter to the cosmos, because I think the cosmos is not doing a weighing and measuring action. it's actually responding and growing to every human soul that is able to give back to it what it is giving out to us. We are in this reverberative relationship with the cosmos. And there are three ways in which this can work. One is in attention. If we pay a certain kind of attention, we change the world. Okay, it's the bit of the world we know, but that ramifies endlessly. And if everybody does it, then it's a massive effect. Secondly, I believe that God, I've suggested that God actually and the cosmos, his creation, are in a kind of a dance of creation in which each is furthering the other. God made an other that would reflect itself, and so there is this dynamic. And so, do you know Pascal's wager? Pascal, the mathematician and philosopher, he had a wager which always seemed rather venal to me, but which went like this. He was a religious man. Either there is a God or there isn't. If there is a God, you'd jolly well better believe in him. But if there isn't a God, it won't do any harm believing in him. So obviously the thing any rational person does is believe in God. It used to worry me that you can't necessarily influence what you believe, but I now know that you can. But I have McGilchrist's wager, which is slightly different, and it goes like Pascal's wager for the first two, but it then adds a third element to this wager, which is perhaps it's not just straightforwardly that there is a God or there isn't, but there is a divine something that needs us and is nourished by our responsiveness. And so it's not just a wager, it's about a duty we have, a calling we have, a noble calling we have, to be in response to that, and that that helps to rejuvenate the world. It's involved in tikkun, in that repair. And that's what we're here for, to resonate with divinity, to resonate with the high values of beauty, goodness and truth.
I think that relates to something that you wrote in on creativity.
Okay.
Where you point out the ability to invent is essential to survival.
Yes.
This capacity has reached extraordinary heights in humans because of our ability to imagine. And then you say that creative acts depend on how we dispose our consciousness.
Exactly.
What do you mean by that? Particularly the association of those two words, creativity and consciousness, and how we dispose our consciousness. Is that?
Well, what I mean by that is, I mean, to cut it short, attention is the way in which we choose to dispose our consciousness. So if I can dispose my consciousness is always consciousness of something. And I can dispose my consciousness towards that something with a whole range of modes. Some of them dismissive, diminishing. Some welcoming and nourishing. And so the way in which we do this matters. The way we attend matters, as I say. Like the wager matters. How we think of what we're doing matters. If you're asking me what is consciousness, then we're into a different game. But perhaps I could mention. Again, I have a very long chapter on matter and consciousness, which I probably should publish as a separate book, because it's about book length, like a chapter on the sacred. But what I argue is that effectively I look at all the possibilities for consciousness, and that consciousness may be emitted by matter, may be transmitted by matter, or may be permitted by matter. That just about sums it up. Now, the most unlikely of these is the one we believe, that somehow matter will exude consciousness, it will emit it. This is improbable for all sorts of reasons that I argue. Unless matter already has somewhat of consciousness in it, in which case you haven't explained how matter came about because you smuggled it into your... Sorry, how consciousness came about because you smuggled it into your matter. So, to cut a long story short, I think that consciousness is permitted by the material that is ourselves and other living creatures. And I believe that all living creatures are conscious. And I believe that consciousness pervades the universe. This means not just that it is kind of running around in the universe, but it actually grounds every single thing that exists. So, to use philosophical terminology, consciousness is an ontological primitive. It is the existence behind which, beyond which, you cannot go. It is the most basic thing. And matter is a version of consciousness. It is a form of consciousness, or as chemists and physicists say, a phase. You know, they talk about phases of water. one of which is translucent and flowing and runs across your hand. In another, it's solid, immobile and opaque and extremely cold and so hard it can break your head open. In another, it's in this room in tons, otherwise we wouldn't be able to breathe. Which of them is the real water? Well, they're all water. They're just in different phases, and they don't look like one another. The water in this room doesn't look like a stream or like a block of ice. So matter is what we experience in our consciousness that is relatively persistent and relatively resistant. I can't put my hand through this table, however much I may want to. I'm not a kung fu master yet. So these are the differences. Material, what we call matter, is aspects of our experience, our conscious experience. Everything we know is parts of our experience that seem to resist our will and seem to persist for a while. And that is a form of consciousness. So matter is a way in which consciousness can manifest itself. And spirit is another. So that's the way in which I see it. That they're not separate, and nor are they at war with one another, and nor, above all, can they all just be reduced to matter.
Would it be true then to say that consciousness is also a gift, in the sense that we're conscious of something, and therefore the recognition of that, of the other, fundamentally
absolutely
is a gift?
It is a gift. Everything comes to us as a gift. We brought nothing here. It's all a gift. Everything that happens to us is a gift. Life is a gift. Suffering is a gift. Joy is a gift. Relationship is a gift. None of these things are our making. And so an attitude of humility and gratitude is a good way to get through life, really.
You say attention is a creative act. And creation is really about this, the induction of a highly attentive state. It means we have to remain open, and this, it's somewhat like prayer. Can you amplify that? You talked
yes
about Simone Weil also saying earlier about attention as a type of love.
Yes,
as well.
Yes, that's right. But what I was referring to here was more this idea of creating a space for something to happen. So too often we think, in our modern Western way, that for something to happen, we must set about making it happen. We must do this, and then that, and the next thing. But we don't really know where that will lead, and very often it turns out it leads somewhere we didn't anticipate and we didn't want. What instead we need to do is to stop thinking that we're in control of this and wait for the gift, not in a passive way, like just sitting there going, hello, but instead actively disposing ourselves towards the creative cosmos so that it can create something. We can create a field for it to happen, or we cannot. If we're constantly crowding it out with our own thoughts, our own ideas, our own plans, then it can't do anything. But as I often say, a gardener can't make a plant. A gardener is given a plant, and the gardener can either let it grow or it can stifle it. And the gardener's job is basically to get everything out of the way to allow this thing to flourish. And that's really true of our lives, that we need to get out of the way that is getting between us and the things that we really wish for. And that means being open and attentive. And I believe prayer is like this. Who am I to talk to you about prayer? I only have my own understanding, but a lot of wise people have suggested that prayer is not about requesting things, but is about, in fact, St. Francis said that when you pray, you should ask for nothing, nothing. I'm not sure I entirely agree, because some aspects of this relationship is being able to express a need, but also not to put attachments or conditions or anything, but just to say if it be your will. And I think that business of prayer as a very trained, disciplined, open alertness, but which is basically passive, is really important, because we're actively using our ability to create, to make that space and to be for the moment passive so that something can come to us.
Finally, in this section, can I ask you about emotions?
Yes.
You've discussed the difference between left and right hemisphere of the brain. Is it possible to leverage this this understanding to enhance our emotional well-being.
Are you saying what can we learn from hemisphere theory about emotional well-being?
Yes. And emotional regulation, maybe, too.
Yes. Well, okay. Interestingly, the left hemisphere is not unemotional at all, but it specializes in rather superficial self-regarding emotions. So it tends to major in things like anger, self-righteousness, and disgust. All the sort of things that those who just know what is right for this world are constantly exhibiting on Twitter. But the right hemisphere is more tentative, more forgiving, more compassionate, and the deeper, more complex emotions that cost us something, rather than just externalizing our rage and frustration, are subtended by the right hemisphere more than the left. So they both deal with emotions, but they deal with different timbre, different types of emotions. And you might think that the right hemisphere, being much more skilled at emotion, would require the left hemisphere somehow to keep it in check. But just because it's more skilled in emotion, it's also the one that helps regulate emotion. So the left hemisphere dominant person not only rages, but knows no end to their rage. They're just a rage. Mm. They have no self-control. Whereas somebody who has a properly cultivated right hemisphere not only feels the deep emotions, but also is in touch with the need to regulate them. We really need what it is in every respect that it can tell us, morally, and the moral difference is very interesting as well, emotionally, intellectually and spiritually.
Dr. McGilchrist, thank you very much for responding so warmly to my naive question.
Thank you very much indeed. They're very good questions.